Hello and welcome to the program. Today, shocking news that for every 100 salmon that leave Irish waters, only 5 return. With the advent of new generation cars, bicycles and motorbikes, we talk to motoring journalist Michael Sheridan about the prospects of e-transport and how the study of ancient plants can inform us about our past and provide warning signs for the future. We continue our series on climate change.
The real banks of the world are seed banks. I mean, you can't eat money, but you can eat seeds, and the seeds produce the crops. So it's so fundamental how plants respond to climate change, because they are our food, they are our fuel, and they're also most likely one of the most important solutions to get us out of this mess that we've caused, climate change.
You can visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney. Now, from Carramore Lake to the River Nore to Loch Curran to the Boyne, a rich and wide network of rivers and lochs makes Ireland an important refuge for wild salmon. We've spoken about salmon on this programme for donkey's years, attracting anglers back year after year. But numbers of fishermen, we're told, are now in decline as numbers of salmon have fallen dramatically, down about 85% from the mid-1970s, from, wait for it, 1.7 million to about 300,000 or thereabouts today. In the past, up to 30% of young salmon leaving Irish rivers returned to spawn. In recent years, that figure has fallen to about 5%. Some experts are saying we are now at crisis point. But why the collapse of one of our most iconic native species? Well, recently Dr. Kieran Byrne, CEO of Inland Fisheries Ireland, brought us the alarming news that for every 100 Irish salmon that go out to sea, 95 don't come back. Kieran Byrne is in studio with us now, along with Dr. Richard Collins. Kieran, you're very welcome to the programme. Thank you for coming in. Now, you say you are deeply concerned about salmon abundance levels. Is it really that bad? For every 100 that go to sea, only 5 come back? And if that is the case, how do you know? Did you count every one of them individually?
Well, yeah, it is actually that bad, and we are deeply concerned. And you just, your intro, though, Derek, you gave the key statistics. We talk about the scientists now, the great people with all the numbers, calculate a thing called the pre-fishery abundance, PFA.
Okay.
And that's the estimate number of salmon that are out in the ocean before anybody gets at them, any netsman or angler or anything like that. And we reckon in around the mid-1970s, it peaked at about 1.7 million. Last year, you're hovering between 250 and 350,000 salmon.
You know this for a fact.
Yeah, well, no, you know, you have to be very careful here. We're not going into a warehouse. I'm often quoted as saying it's counting tins of beans on a shelf and lining them up. We're talking about animals that move in very fluvial dynamic systems. So all we have in our agency, we have a network of 32 fish counters up and across the country. And so, for example, when fish come back in, for example, to the Galway Weir, every single fish that comes into Galway to go up into Loch Corrib is counted through a fish counter. So we don't have a counter on every single river in the country, but we have an index of various rivers. That's one thing we do. The next thing we do is we look at the other side of the equation. For example, it's the juvenile fish. So you have adults coming in, and then up in the spawning catchments, you'll have juveniles. So we've, over the last probably 15 years or so, we've established a thing called a catchment-wide electrofishing index. So if you go to a stretch of river and you electrofish it using electrical technology, you'll get some sense of the number of juveniles. So if you've lots of babies in the river, generally speaking, you've had a good spawning year and adults made it up there to produce those babies.
Okay.
So we use a figure, for example, and we do a thing called a 5-minute, it's a very standardised type of approach. It's called a 5-minute electrofishing. Now, I'll explain a little bit more maybe after about the other type of approach, but this is a quick zap. So you go up along a river and you do 5 minutes, certain stretch, how many juveniles you get. And the thing is, when you do that repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly, you start to build up a profile of what's good and what's bad. And we've been using a figure of approximately 17 juvenile salmon per 5-minute fishing, which suggests that there's quite a sufficient number of juveniles. And we've been able over years to link
now, can I just I want to take you back a little bit, because you said electrofishing.
Yeah.
You're using an electric prod, which you're dipping into the water, and that stuns the fish.
Yep.
They float to the surface almost as if they're dead, and then you physically count them.
Yep.
You're not walking along the bank looking at juveniles in the water and catch because they're moving.
Yeah, no,
you
no,
can't
no.
do that. You're going to. Am I correct in
you're
thinking?
Absolutely,
that? Does that not damage the fish? Could that not be the reason there's only five of them coming back instead of 100?
Well, yeah, you're raising a really good question, Derek, and you're right about that. First of all, the unit we use for the walking is a backpack unit, so it's like a fancy backpack. But what you must do, and the guys are expert at doing this, is using the right amount of voltage. So you tickle the fish. I wouldn't say stun it. It kind of turns over ever so slightly. But I put a huge pulse in, you can actually damage the fish, right? But these are techniques that have been tried and tested. It's our number one tool in the toolbox of fishery management techniques. So it's done all over the world. So we've got lots of expertise and lots of information about conductivity of water, how much voltage you use, etc., etc. So when it's done right, it doesn't have an impact on the fish. So you'll be able to count them. So we get a figure of 17, right? So 17 is fine. So 17 means that's 17 juveniles per 5 minute fishing, and that's quite a high number. So when we find 17, we're saying, yeah, there's a healthy number of juveniles in that river. And let me give an example of where it happens. So you have situations on Northwest Mayo, not that far from Carrimore in your introduction, actually, where we do the electrofishing. And you look at the river system, you say, God, you know what? There's huge numbers of juveniles in that river. That's great. So the juvenile situation is great. But salmon go out to sea, take a right turn off Ireland and off to go into the North Atlantic, sometimes off past Iceland, sometimes off past Norway, and sometimes off to the west of Greenland. And then they come back. So places like the Owenmore River, which we had a problem with, you look at the engine which is producing the juveniles, and it's fine. There's plenty of juveniles. So you'd say, well, you'd have to say, well, the problem probably isn't in the river. So where's the problem? It's the number of fish coming back.
Okay, could it not be further downstream?
It might be. And this is a new experiment we're doing as well. So what we're trying to do is you start up at the headwater of a river and you track it all the way across. So my team there, we're doing it in the National Salmonid Catchment Index out in the Airif River. We're using radio telemetry, right, and PIT, passive integrated transponder tags, which are fairly fancy types of tags. So you'll actually put them into the juvenile smolt, which is a tiny fish, as they're migrating down the river, down into the estuary and out to go. So what we've done in the Airif, because it's in the Killary Harbour, which is Ireland's only natural fjord, we've got these little transponders in the fish and we track them
all the way down. So you know they're making it.
Well, you see, here's the rub. What we're learning now is actually quite a few of them aren't making it. So the learning from this new experimentation is that actually there's quite a high level of mortality before they ever get into the open ocean, if you want. So even from the top of the river to the bottom of the river, and from the river, if you want to call it the very mouth of the river, to the end of the estuary.
Okay, so before we make it out into open water, what's causing the mortality in the rivers? Is it pollution or is it poaching?
Well, no.
I mean, what you want is GPS on these fish to find out where they end up.
We have that as well. We've done that too. So you're looking at
somebody's door someday saying, well, excuse me, are you eating salmon that you shouldn't be eating?
We've done that too. So the interesting thing, but with the kind of technology we have, we've got satellite tagging technology, for example. We've tracked salmon out to 800 miles out in the ocean. And we had a really interesting piece. It was a couple of years ago now when you looked at CTD, conductivity, temperature, depth tags, this type of tag. It pops off after a certain amount of time and you get information from it. And you look at salmon traveling the top surface of the water thereabouts, and they do little dives here and there, and his temperature's at whatever, 12 degrees passive water temperature, and next thing you know, you see a salmon with a temperature profile of 38 degrees, and you're going, holy God, where did that come from? And it turns out those salmon were eaten probably by pilot whales. So the tag went in and went back out again.
Wow.
And we took the information.
Isn't
now that's
that
a number
story?
Of years ago.
Okay, but that's out at sea. That's not up in your
let's go back to the Dodder. And what you'll find in biological systems, and Derek, you'd be really well aware of this from your experience in the wildlife scenario, there's never any singles, or very rarely is there a single smoking gun. So you'll find this is a multitude of factors, and in any given year one factor might have a greater priority than another factor. So let's go back, let's look at last summer, for example. We had extended high water temperatures, incredibly low water levels. I mean, basically salmon, I suppose it'd be fair to say, they were nearly baking for a good chunk of the summer, right? So you'd have to wonder physiologically, what does that do to the salmon when it matures over the winter and goes out this spring?
So when it gets down to the water, it's not in good health, really.
Exactly. You've got water. You've got water quality, right? If you look at water quality as an example, we know, in Ireland, we have really improved our water quality. It's a great, in one level, it's a great success story from the 80s and the days when practically every other week there was a massive fish kill. So the overall water quality has improved. But what's a real concern to us is the really high quality, pristine water sites have nearly absolutely declined very significantly. And where does salmon exist most? In the high quality water sites. So your water quality. You've predation. Let's talk about predation for a second now. I can tell you the estimated surplus of salmon in the country that we're allowed to harvest. I can tell you how many we're allowing for draft net fishermen, which is the commercial nets. I can tell you how many we're allowing for recreational fishermen. I can tell you which rivers we decide are on such concern that they're closed for fishing. I can tell you which rivers are open for catch and release angling, and which rivers have a harvest. What I can't tell you is how many Cormans do we have in the country? Mm-hmm. How many do we need? How many seals do we have in the country? Mm-hmm. How many do we need? So there's a fundamental difference there.
So they're all predating on the salmon.
They're all predating.
Well.
And don't get me wrong, this is not about going shooting all Cormans.
I do notice a lot of Cormans around, by the way.
And we've seen Cormans.
The East Coast, anyway.
And you'll know this better than I will. Cormans have moved inland from in 20, 30 years ago. They were a seabird. They were a marine bird that you'd only ever see out in the marine. They've moved inland because some of their feeding is not available as it was. But the difference there is we manage salmon for exploitation. So I can tell you, one river up in northwest Donegal has a surplus, a harvestable surplus of 50 fish. Right? So we will work very closely with an angling club and ensure that only 50 fish are taken from that river. That's the surplus there, 50 fish is all. How many cormorants are at the bottom of that river? Mm. So the difference there is one of them we're managing for exploitation in a sustainable way. And that's salmon. Excuse me, the others we're protecting. And there's a philosophical difference there. You're protecting, and they should be protected. But to what end? What is the right number of seals to have at the estuary of the River Feel, the Cashin estuary? What is the right number of seals?
Well, I suppose I could say to you, is a fisherman a natural predator? Yeah. I don't want to cause aspersions on their good character. Richard's given me the eyes there. But I mean, are they telling you the truth? Are they only taking 50 fish?
Well, no. Therein lies a rope as well. The majority, I put my hand in my heart and say the majority of people are upright, honest people. Absolutely, they're telling us the truth. But there is a thing called IUU, illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing. So we would be somewhat naive to think that everything that's been reported is only what's caught. But you can get indices, and again, you don't just do it on your own. You look at other countries, you benchmark, you see what averages are. Anywhere there is a fishery where you have a commercial value on it, there will be IUU.
Because the people who are into birds will tell you the birds are moving upstream either because they're under pressure along the coast or because they've realised it's easier to catch fish in the rivers when you move upstream. But they're doing what comes naturally to them.
Yes.
But whereas you put the fisherman into the equation, and well, he's not really a natural predator, is he?
No, but I'm afraid you're going to have... I'm a scientific and management guy. You want to bring a philosopher in for that
one,
I'm afraid.
Well, we go here in the left-hand corner. Richard Collins, have you got one of those boxing bells? Ding, ding. Richard, you're on.
Well, Kieran, you are not just a fishery expert. You're also an accountant.
Yeah.
Now, if we look at the balance sheet for the salmon, we have productivity, and I get the impression more or less that things are good at the productive side. They manage to produce as many young as they used to, and so we're delivering the right amount. The little babies, the smolts, head out to sea, and they have to go off to some feeding ground somewhere, and then those that survive come back, and here the balance sheet begins to look very dull indeed, because the number coming back is greatly reduced. Mm-hmm. It's not the productivity, it's either then in the travelling up to the feeding grounds wherever they are, or competition perhaps, or something like that, or predation in the feeding grounds that is reducing their numbers, or perhaps there's something else, lice. Would you like to elaborate on the balance sheet?
Thank you for drawing a wonderful analogy with accountancy, and there is a lot of analogy and similarities. Yeah, you've hit it very nicely, Richard, actually. There's a number of factors. Let's start with the salmon up the river. He gets down. He's having a bit of a difficult time because water quality may not be at his best. He then hits a couple of barriers along the way. Sitting on the side of those barriers might be or might not be some cormorants and herons. He gets out to sea the early part and he's hitting some seals. Then he goes past a fish farming installation that unfortunately may or may not have lice levels at the right level. The smolt, just for your listeners, the salmon smolt, the wild salmon smolt is probably about 10 to 12 centimetres long and maybe 30, 40 grams. He's just changed, and this is very important, from the freshwater situation, which is just all freshwater, into the sea situation. So he's undergrown a massive physiological change in a very short period of time. So the nearest analogy to that is like puberty, I guess, like teenagers, like going from the age of 10 to the age of 14 in a very short period of time. So they're very vulnerable. If they get a certain number of lice on them, it can have it can kill them.
So, where do they get the lice from?
Well, lice are naturally occurring. Right? So they occur in the environment. But what happens in some of the fish farming installations, if they're not managed correctly at the right time, they get a disproportionate burden of sea lice. So we have a window, we call it the smolt migration phase, around the April-May time, that if you can manage the lice in the fish farm at that time, the smolt swim on past out to the North Atlantic and they're okay.
You mentioned the word fish farm. Are fish farms primarily responsible for the presence of lice?
In the abundance levels, they are. Yeah. Now, people will argue there's a huge debate going on this last 30 years about salmon lice and aquaculture and all the rest. But the simple fact of the matter is, we've published scientific research that shows that up to an additional 39% of mortality can be attributable to lice from fish farms. So they can have a disproportionate impact. But that's not to say all fish farms are bad. Where they're managed correctly, and there are examples of that, where they're done at the right time, the juvenile salmons, because they swim out, take a right turn, they're okay. Now, it can impact on sea trout, I should say, and we would have seen the collapse of the sea trout stock in Connemara in the 1980s, primarily because of that.
So I get the impression that the file on sea lice has been sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions, and he has not yet reported back, and we can't at this stage blame him. Now, the salmon go on up, and due to the warming of the sea, presumably they have to go further afield or into areas they're not formerly familiar with. What is the picture up there?
Well, the picture is a kind of a mixed picture, and we would have done, and your colleague Ken Whelan told you quite a lot about this previously, a lot of work out in the Salsea programme looking at the situation at sea. And so you've got, again, a multitude of factors. You've got, as you say, temperature changes. One of the things, interesting enough, is because fresh water is getting warmer, when the juveniles smoltify earlier, there's a concern that they're getting to sea earlier and there's not the initial feeding. And you, as in the bird world, you'd see this exactly as well with something like the little tits where the chicks are hatching earlier and the caterpillars aren't available at the right time. There's a bit of a mismatch. But you go up to the high seas, you're seeing a situation where we've got change in temperatures, you know, these North Atlantic oscillations. You've got an estimated change in where the feeding is. Now, we know this because we've seen salmon coming back after the summer's feeding, a winter's feeding at sea, that should be 6, 7, 8 pounds, and they're coming back in 2 and 3 pounds. So clearly they're emaciated. They're not getting the level of feeding that they need to be. And then you got salmon in different rivers in Ireland coming back looking very healthy. So we know the salmon are going to different places. So they're hitting the feeding. They may not be hitting the feeding. There's a new theory afoot, which is gaining some credence in relation to competition with things like mackerel. One of our scientific colleagues in Norway has done an awful lot of work on this idea of the competition and predation by large mackerel and salmon smolts. And all you need to do, he says, look at the abundance of the mackerel stocks relative to the abundance of salmon stocks. So at sea, there's a very complex set of factors. As you can imagine, it's really difficult to work at sea. So it's nice to know we've used isotope analysis to figure out to a degree where the salmon are going. Now, isotope analysis, by the way, is a kind of a fancy technique to almost like taste the water. You look at the relative balance of carbon and nitrogen in a water, and you can use it almost as a signal for a particular water type. So you can figure that out from the salmon scales up to the North Atlantic. But here's the rub. This is what we do in our agency. I talk a lot about controlling the controllables. Right, you go back to that balance sheet again, right? And you go back to business. It says there's no point in worrying about things you can control. It's nice to know them, and they're very important to know, but we got to put our efforts into things we can control.
Is there a possibility that he just isn't strong enough to get to where he needs to go?
That is a really good question, Richard. You're very much on the money there, because the question we're now asking is about, we talk about stronger smolts. So what we can control is making sure we have the maximum number of the healthiest smolts possible. And again, my colleagues in the kind of the biochemistry side of things looks at the energetic levels and saying, are salmon getting the right level of feeding? You would see this also, this kind of issue also in some of the seabirds, that they're changing their diet. They're not getting quite the levels of energy required. You'll see it as well, I think, on barn owls, where they've moved into feeding on Clethodontimus, the bank fold, which isn't giving them the same level of nutrients. And it's harder to work on, obviously, in the sea situation, but there's a really good question there. Is, are they having to travel further? Are they having to work harder? And then if you think about this, in parasitology, we use this idea of windows, lining up a window. If you lined up 6 windows together and you'd be able to see through all those windows, if you slot one out to the left or the right, you don't get a view. So there's windows of transmission. So you have a good year. So the temperature's cool enough in the water. There's a bit of feeding. The smolts leave at the right time. They get out okay. They don't get hit by sea lice predation too bad. And they hit the feeding at sea. What we've seen there is Mother Nature can really, really fix it. They can come back in great numbers. But you have a bad year. You spent, for example, a whole pile of time in high water temperatures, low water, getting a bit stressed, a little bit of oxygen. You get hit with predation. Maybe sea lice isn't as good. And then by the time you finally get out there, it's moved 500 miles north or 300 miles to the west, and you can't find it anyway. So these are the kind of things we're looking at. And so in any given cycle, it's a mixture of all of those factors.
So that's another file for the Director of Public Prosecutions. Now he has 2 files about the salmon. The other factor, that third factor, begins to emerge. We're looking at a population shift. The salmon is moving northwards. Norway, Iceland are providing salmon as well. Now, if our little baby salmon has to struggle to get up to the feeding grounds, is he at a disadvantage vis-a-vis the smolts who come out of the rivers further north? As with your business hat on, you know that if the balance sheet doesn't work out, you go to the wall, you're in stubs. Yeah. Do the salmon go into stubs because they can't compete with their Nordic brethren?
Well, no, I don't think there's a direct competition, but you've hit a really good point. In international salmon terms, we're in the North Atlantic, so we break it broadly into three groups. One is up around Greenland, one is around America, and the other one is the Eastern Atlantic. And we break the Eastern Atlantic into the North and the South. And we're obviously in the South part of it. So ourselves, the UK, France, Spain, Portugal. Right? So you can imagine, as you're well aware, where temperatures are rising, these are cold water fish species, they're moving north. So in the northern part of the East Atlantic, right up northern Norway and right up the top there, they're doing okay. The stocks are doing okay. They're not brilliant, but they're doing okay. In the southern part of the stock, which is ourselves, the UK and all around southern Iceland, they are under pressure. And again, we don't have full information on that, but are they actually having to go further north, or are the sea temperatures just not optimal? And we know this from biological systems. Optimal can be a very narrow window range. So even a degree or two on average on the sea temperature or summer temperature can change and can give one species a competitive advantage over another species. So I don't think they're competing directly with their northern colleagues, but I do think when they're getting up to those feeding grounds, the feeding grounds may be moving a little bit north as well.
So back to the original point. Are only 5 salmon out of every 100 coming back to Irish rivers? And if so, what is the main reason? If we know it, and what can we do about it, if anything?
Well, the answer is yes, and that's a variable figure. So we peaked to our bottom in 2013, we hit about 3. Now, salmon's life history strategy, Derek, is that they produce a lot of eggs, the majority don't survive. But if you were trading in normal times, going back to the balance sheet analogy, you'd be looking for about between 15 and 25% of those fish coming back. We're now hovering around 5, 6, 7. We went to 3% in 2013. Last year wasn't such a good year, so we're at the bottom. That's what's happening. So what can we do about it? We can't control what's happening to the left side of Iceland or far up Norway. But what we can control is predation. We can control water quality to a degree. We can control our barriers to a degree. And we can try and give those juvenile salmon the maximum amount of chance possible to get out there. So in a weird kind of way, it's a numbers game. So the more smolts that you can get out there in good condition, the better chance you have of getting them back.
And you're working on that?
We are working on that.
Good for you. Anyway, stay with us. We're going to be talking about e-transport very shortly, and I know that's something you're particularly interested in. But right now, we continue our series here on Mooney Goes Wild for the month of July. Each week, we hear from a leading voice on what has become the defining global challenge of our time, and that is climate change.
The real banks of the world are seed banks. I mean, you can't eat money, but you can eat seeds, and the seeds produce the crops. So it's so fundamental how plants respond to climate change, because they are our food, they are our fuel, and they're also most likely one of the most important solutions to get us out of this mess that we've caused, climate change.
Professor Jennifer McIlwain is a paleobotanist. Paleo means old, and botany is the study of plants. So she studies fossil plants, many of them older than dinosaurs. These ancient plant remains not only tell us a great deal about climate change in the past, but can provide critical clues and warning signs for the future. Chair of Botany at Trinity College Dublin, Jennifer works on the Programme for Experimental Atmospheres and Climate, or PEAC. The programme simulates a range of environmental conditions, allowing scientists to become time travellers who can then predict how a changing climate will affect the Earth's plant life. Intrigued by such cutting-edge research, Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens of Ireland, recently went along to meet Jennifer to see some of her experimental work close up at the School of Biology and Environmental Science in UCD.
I'm standing in a quiet corner of the UCD campus in Rosemount, and we're in an extraordinary glasshouse full of an amazing collection of plants. And I'm here with Professor Jenny McIlwain. And Jenny has spent many years of her research life here at UCD, recently moved to Trinity. Jenny, tell us a bit about the collection of plants we have before us.
So, as you say, we've got a wonderful array of plants here. We've got ancient plants, we've got modern crop plants, all for environmental and experimental research. All the scientists here in Ireland are asking, how will climate change influence the plant world here in Ireland and also globally?
And one of the exciting things about your research, Jenny, has been, you know, you've worked in paleobotany, looking at fossil plants, and today you are looking at climate change. So perhaps you would like to tell us a little about You know, what got you into paleobotany and how does that illuminate the sort of modern world?
Well, I suppose I think it goes all the way back to being an undergrad, and I remember my lectures at the time describing how plants had changed through time. And as an undergrad, I thought, oh my goodness, everything has a history. Even plants have a history. So we look at what's around us here today in the glasshouse or on a walk through the woods in Ireland today, but you have to think that everything has changed. Time has changed, climate's changed, atmosphere has changed. And as an undergrad, I thought that was really powerful. So my interest in paleobotany is we can learn so much from climate of the past and how it's shaped the environment of the past and plant life of the past. And because in the deep geological past, climates were much warmer than today, more similar to where we're going in our future if we don't change our behaviour, paleobotany really has a lot to give, and we can learn a lot from it to make predictions about what's going to happen in the future.
One of the extraordinary problems that we face in understanding climate change is we live on just one Earth with one history. So to understand what's happened in the past is a great example of the elegance of science, that you can actually take a fossilised plant from 50 or 200 million years ago, and that will tell us about the conditions that that plant grew up in. So, Jenny, can you outline roughly what it is when you dig out one of these fossils? What is it that tells you the world was so different, the climate was so different then?
So, for me, and I think most naturalists, plants are the original sensor. So we have sensors in our watches, we have sensors all around our environment that sense what was the temperature of the environment, what's the atmospheric composition of the environment. But plants do that innately. So if I take a fossil plant, I can actually look at its shape and its structure, its morphology and anatomy. I can look at its chemistry. I can look at the number of stomata, the breathing pores on the leaf surface, and I can actually, from that information, deduce what the climate was hundreds of millions of years ago, and more importantly, what the atmospheric composition was millions of years ago. And this is really important because if we can understand, for example, how much carbon there is in the atmosphere and how warm the temperature of the Earth was, you can begin to understand this relationship of if we burn fossil fuels, how is it going to affect global temperature? Well, we can use information from fossil plants in the geological past to look at that relationship. If you raise carbon dioxide by this much, how much is going to warm globally the Earth's temperature by?
So when you get a fossil plant and you're talking about these stomata, the little breathing pores on the undersurface of a leaf, what is it about them that tells you the CO2 levels were different?
So carbon dioxide in the air is like, I suppose it's like plant food. And the more carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere, the more plant food that's available. So plants are very clever. They have a relationship between the number of stomata on the leaf surface and the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. The more carbon in the atmosphere, plants develop fewer stomata. By doing that, they can get the same amount of carbon for photosynthesis, for the production of sugars, but the huge benefit is that they lose less water. So we know from modern studies, experimental work, that if you subject a plant to a high carbon dioxide level, one similar to, let's say, the year 2050, by the time a new leaf has developed on that plant, it will have fewer stomata on the leaf surface than the old leaf did. So we can use, it's a really simple relationship, but it's very powerful, and we can, simply by counting the number of stomata on the leaf and calibrating it, we can estimate really precisely how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere 50 million years ago or 200 million years ago.
So at one point in your career, from looking at the distant past, you have suddenly become fascinated by the future of our climate. And this facility here in Rosemount, tell us a bit about how it came about.
Rosemount, long been on the corner of UCD campus, and probably not a lot of people knew about it, but there's always lots of work going on. And we really built up this great facility, which is a national facility for Ireland. And what it enables plant scientists to do is to simulate climates and atmospheres of any time in Earth history, so the deep geological past or the future. And then experimentally, we can grow our plant of interest, whether it's barley for beer production or cycads, some ancient plant from Mexico, or whatever the plant of interest, we can grow them in these experimental conditions and observe how they change when they're exposed to a different climate or a different atmospheric composition. And when we understand that, it allows us to read those signals in the plants and build up complex mathematical data sets. But in essence, it's basically learning how the plants are adapting to these experimental conditions. And then we can go back to the fossil record and use that information to work out the climates of the past. But I think even more importantly, it allows us to say something of how are plants going to respond in the future, if we continue on this path of, I suppose, globalization, burning of fossil fuels, land use change.
So here in this glasshouse, there's a lot of oat plants and barley plants, I can see. What has been the effect, do you think, of if we anticipate continuous rise in CO2 levels, what is going to be the effect upon Irish agricultural crops?
So some of the experiments we've done has shown that typical pathogens, so fungal pathogens of crop plants in Ireland, when you expose them to future climate or future CO2 concentration, the pathogen adapts faster than the crop plant. And the pathogen is boosted under high carbon dioxide. So what that study shows us is that even though plants have the capacity to adapt to future climate change, fungal pathogens which reduce yield can do so faster because they have a shorter lifespan, so they can adapt much faster. So they're always one step ahead of the plant's defences. That's one example. Then on the other side, you may see a boost in productivity. So if you choose the right variety, under a high carbon dioxide world, they'll lose less water. They may show an increase in productivity. But this would be the case in an Irish climate. If you go to the tropics, this wouldn't be the case, because even though carbon dioxide would usually boost the biomass and the growth of the plant, the temperature is going to suppress, because the temperature is going to raise up so much in the tropics, it's going to have a negative impact. So it's really complex, and I suppose it depends where you are.
Like you say, Jenny, it's a very complex question, and one of the things I know that Rosemount features are all these different growth chambers. So it might be nice for us to go and have a look at how these growth chambers are informing this knowledge, this research you're doing.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's go and have a look at those.
So, Jenny, you brought me into an extraordinary room with five big humming green boxes, well numbered, 10, 11, 12, and we're standing next door to number 13. What is this construction?
So this is a plant growth chamber, or you could also call it a simulated climate chamber. So they're wonderful pieces of scientific kit, and what they allow us to do is to take a programme of a climate from anywhere in the world today, and to program it into the actual chamber. So, for example, today, number 13 is running a Mexican hot, humid climate. So we can control the light, we can control the day-night cycle, we can control temperature, humidity, but most importantly, we can control the atmosphere. So we can simulate an atmosphere from the future or the past, or today, but it really gives us this great experimental control.
So, Jenny, could we have a look inside this particular chamber?
Yeah, let's open it up. So I'm opening up this chamber now, and we can feel this lovely flood of warm 70% humidity air, and the temperature in the chamber is 25 degrees centigrade. So it's a really tropical. And that hiss you've just heard, that's the atmospheric nozzles which are spraying humidity to keep this really high humidity in the chambers.
Very impressive. And all these little seedlings, I see you've got a huge number of freshly germinated things. Well, they're about 20, 30 centimetres tall now. What are these plants?
So these are, they're called mangroves, and there's two different species, black and white mangroves. And these were collected very recently in Mexico from by one of my postdocs, John Devney. And he's funded by the Irish Research Council. And what we're doing with these seedlings is trying to understand how future climate change and future increases in greenhouse gases will affect the native range of these tiny little seedlings, which are hugely important for the people of Senegal, Mexico, all over the tropics, because these are used in their farming and fisheries and for flood defences.
Jenny, thank you for that. That's a fascinating transport into the tropics instantly. Maybe we'll go and look at some of the other chambers here.
Yeah, let's do that. I'm going to close the door now to keep this climate just perfect.
Extraordinary. That was a modern day climate in there, I presume. So we're looking at the same levels of CO2. But one of the clever things about these chambers you were describing is you can set them to the past or the future. Could we have a look at one of the chambers where we're doing such an experiment?
Yeah, so if we walk straight over this lab, over to chamber number 10, in that chamber over there, it's the exact same climate as we've just physically experienced by opening the door. The only thing we've changed is the carbon dioxide content. So we've doubled the carbon dioxide content. So today, this chamber, number 13, has got 400 parts per million. And as we walk over the lab to the other side, that's running at 800 parts per million, so double the modern atmosphere.
Yep. So, Jenny, we've moved over to chamber 10 here, and I notice a nice little window that I'm opening up. We can see something very similar to the last lot of mangrove seedlings we're looking at. What has changed here?
So this would be a simulation or an atmosphere that we've simulated for the end of the century based on some of the predictions. And what you see right away is that these little seedlings are actually taller than the ones we saw in the low or modern CO2 concentration chambers. So what we've learned and what a lot of other scientists have learned is it's really potent carbon dioxide. It changes everything about a plant, and it can change it in positive ways and it can change it in negative ways. And this is really important because different species will respond differently. Some will benefit from climate change and for some it'll be detrimental. And because you get these different effects, it means that plants perhaps we take for granted are going to become rarer, and other plants that we maybe don't see when we're out walking, they're going to become more dominant.
Well, Jenny, it is extraordinary to see the diversity of work you're doing here, and I think it brings us back to the question of the impact of climate change is clearly going to be fundamental to our world. What do you see from an optimistic point of view as the way that we might tackle some of the problems that we face?
So plants are the sensors of climate change. They tell us what's happening. But really importantly, they are also one of the solutions. So there's many scientists all over the world, including in UCD, TCD, where we're using plants in combination with geology. So, for example, adding ash to crop plants to work out how we can take up carbon from the atmosphere. So they're very much part of the solution that, say, expanding forestry, growing forests for biomass. And I suppose we have to ask, well, why should we all care? And I think we have to come back to, I think, the real banks of the world. Of course, you all know, Matthew, the real banks are seed banks. I mean, you can't eat money, but you can eat seeds, and the seeds produce the crops. So it's so fundamental how plants respond to climate change, because they are our food, they are our fuel, and they're also most likely one of the most important solutions to get us out of this mess that we've caused, climate change.
And I think it certainly reminds me once again of the sheer importance of plant science and botany in providing for the future an optimistic path, a lot of hope. So thank you very much, Jenny. Fascinating to see, you know, research on a truly fundamental level.
Thank you. It's been great showing you around.
Thanks.
And more details can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That was the Chair of Botany at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Jennifer McIlwain, speaking with Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens in Ireland. Now, Irish sales of electric vehicles, or EVs, have increased by 470% in the first quarter of this year. We're told figures from the CSO, the Central Statistics Office, show there were 1,303 electric cars registered in the first 3 months of 2019, and that's up from 229 this time last year. However, sales remain relatively low by international standards, with EVs making up just 4% of total new car registrations. Experts feel this is linked to purchase cost and range anxiety, among other factors. But is this resistance likely to wane with advances in technology and government incentives? And what are the best new models available out there now? Kieran Byrne is still with us because he's got an interest in this subject. And joining us now is motoring journalist with Motor Hub and the Irish Times, Michael Sheridan.
Hi, I'm Derek here. I'm coming in. It's mind yourself. The studio is quite small when you're on an electric scooter.
It is when
scooter.
You're going around and around. Yeah,
don't get confused.
Explain.
It's a fantastic machine. Basically, it's made by Segway. Seat have it under license. They're doing a sort of a sales promotion with it, where they'll throw it in with a new car if you're quick, or they'll charge you 600 quid for it. And it's this part of electric vehicles and the need to worry about not only your journey, but the last kilometre, the last mile, as they call it. And an electric scooter is often ideal to get you that last mile. The trouble is, some people think you're a maniac. Other people think that they shouldn't be on the roads. Some people think they should be licensed and insured. To be honest, this thing can do 25 kilometres distance, and it can do up to 25 kilometres an hour. It's not a menace to society. It has solid rubber wheels. It's reasonably good. You have to have your wits about you. It's like pushing a scooter, a child scooter that you would have been on as a kid. And it's one of those things where some people hate them, some people like them. I think they're actually no harm at all.
Is it an electric vehicle?
It is, has electrical propulsion helping it, but you have to push it to get it to move. So I think it falls into that lovely grey area of like electric bicycles or the mobilettes in France, where you actually have to turn pedals to get it to move. If you don't push it to faster than 3 kilometres per hour, this particular electric scooter won't, the electric assistance won't kick in. But there's a go lever with your right thumb. Your left lever is a stop, and they also have a friction brake on the back, where if you press down on the rear mud guard with your foot, it will give additional braking as well. So I don't really see the need, and it would be impossible to legislate for it. It'd be like saying that the age-old chestnut of every bicycle in the country should have insurance and tax and a registration plate. It's nonsense. Just common cop-on should work in this instance.
Well, you can see pictures of it on the website and a little video, rte.ie/Mooney. Richard, you had a go on it a little bit earlier. You were having difficulty with it too.
I'm still in shock, Derek.
Yeah, I'm sure you are.
I'm wondering
what do you think? I mean, did you ride a scooter when you were a kid?
I was always on scooters when I was a child, yes. A wonderful way to get around. I recommend it highly, but it kind of defeats the purpose. The great thing of putting me on a scooter is I'd get more exercise, and if electricity is driving me, then it kind of compromises.
So you wouldn't be a fan of e-bikes either then, would you?
Well, you could put, if you were using a car, it seems to me, an e-car, and you're afraid you're going to run out of energy, you're going to have no electricity, the car stops. If you had one of these in the boot.
Well, that's the way some manufacturers are selling them, as Michael said at the beginning. Yeah. Anyway, it is the future, let's be honest about it. And that's why you're here today.
And if people are dangerous with them, throw the book at them.
Where are we in relation to electric cars? I mean, in relation to the government's climate action plan, what's going to happen?
They're saying they want 950,000.
And just remind everybody, this is 2019.
Exactly. So they want 950,000 EVs on the road by 2030. That won't happen. The manufacturers can't make them quick enough. It takes at least 3 years from the notion to development. If you're looking at EVs on sale in Ireland, they're getting better, but we have a very restricted pool. I could challenge most people, they wouldn't be able to name. There's 10 or 12 probably on sale, they'd be able to name five. We've seen a massive increase in battery technology, which is great news. E-Niro and E-Soul have just been launched by Kia, and they're part of the Hyundai-Kia group. They've got the electric Kona, the Ioniq, Nissan have the Leaf. What we've seen in recent years is the increase in battery capacity, which is great. So that's the number that people need to look at to make sure their vehicle can go the distance that they need it to go. We've seen the introduction last year of 40 kilowatts in the Nissan Leaf, and now there's even a longer range version with 62, 64 kilowatts. That's important because that brings you above the realistic world 300 kilometre range. And in theory, if you drive like a saint, you can get over 400 kilometres from the current crop of new ones. The big luxury ones are still ridiculous luxury machines like your Tesla. There's the terrific I-Pace from Jaguar, but that's 81,000. And Tesla and the Jag both get the 10 grand grant, which is a bit odd as well. We've got a load of smaller ones coming our way, the 208 from Peugeot and its sister car from DS, and its sister car again, the Opel Corsa. They're coming with interesting super mini sized electric vehicles down the line. But at the moment, you're still very much a hobbyist if you're getting into an EV. If you do get into it, you'll become committed and fanatical. You'll find that the public infrastructure is nowhere up to the task. And if you don't have a home charger, you're really leaving yourself open to a lot of anxieties and stresses. I have a home charger in my house whenever I have an EV on test. I'm always delighted to have it fully charged so that when I go off, I'm not relying on that network. Because if you pull up to a place and it's not working or somebody else is there,
exactly,
you have to engage in a protocol. If there's a committed EV user, they'll have a chat with you. They'll have left a whiteboard and a note with their number saying when they'd be back if they're not attending the car at that point in time. But some people
charge
will just rock
rage.
Up. Charge rage is a massive problem because people have been known to hit the emergency stop on chargers so that their car can get a charge. A lot of the time, if you have a public charge post with two sockets on it, the first car there gets the full charge. The next car to plug in while it's plugged in and active will only get a trickle charge, and it will only swap over when
I have
the other
the
car
solution.
Has its full charge.
And if the Irish government is listening now, and I want commission for this,
yes,
but I have a solution to all of the city councils and all of the county councils where you are in charge of parking spaces where you're charging for people to park their cars, put in induction plates.
Well, induction plates are coming.
Well, that, isn't that
but
the way to do it? That way you don't need to find a charge point.
Absolutely. Or ideally,
you're
induction
not plugging
plates
into
will
anything.
Be built. Ideally, they'd be built into the roads or built into common braking areas like traffic lights and so on, where you can actually get a chance of getting a charge. You've got to remember that councils are very reluctant to give up parking spaces because they're an actual revenue stream.
No, but it'll be still with the parking spaces. So when you park your car, yeah, and you put your money in the meter or whatever way you do it by your mobile phone, it, not only are you paying for the parking, you're paying for the charge.
And the nice thing is that will happen. The industry doesn't really know what it's trying to do because they're reluctant as well to talk to each other because they're in the business of making cars and selling cars for a profit. They've mastered selling diesel and petrol cars and even hybrid cars, which still will use an internal combustion engine. They know how to make profit on those things, but going into the whole areas of batteries and those precious resources and finding and making motors and so on, the electric motor part is fine, but finding the cobalt and the lithium to build the batteries and to harvest this and to make it practical and make it affordable for people
is
who want
the
a car.
Problem.
That's
at the moment,
problem.
These cars are expensive, and not only are they expensive, but to my eye, they're pretty ugly, the ones that are available.
Well, you know,
I don't fancy them at all, and I'll put my hand up. I drive a petrol car.
I was talking to Christophe Dupont in Renault. He was showing me the new Zoe last week in Paris, and he was saying that the early adopters are actually quite proud of having EVs that look like EVs. Because they stand out from the crowd. You know, there's no air vent at the front because they don't need that sort of immediate cooling on a radiator for an engine. They will need battery cooling, many of them, but that's another engineering thing. So a lot of people are happy enough to have an EV which stands out from the crowd. Like, look at the BMW i3, a fantastic piece of engineering, built in Leipzig in a plant where it's powered by windmills. I've seen the production method. I've seen the honeycomb, carbon fiber reinforced plastic body shell, the way they hydroform and, you know, cut with high pressure water and bond the car together with high-tech glues. It's phenomenal, brilliant engineering, structurally fantastic, but still not massively popular because even with the grants, you're still looking at the mid-30s to buy a car.
And
which
it's a small car. It's a town car.
Town car. Lovely car to drive. Brilliant. And EVs are fantastic. When you get into them, they just have a go pedal and a stop pedal. They're whisper quiet. They actually have to generate noise because you'll have
to. But then we're just going back to the future. My father worked in the Swastika Laundry in Ballsbridge, and part of his job was to recharge the old red and white Swastika Laundry vans, which were battery powered.
And I remember the milk floats only too well.
And they were just stop and go.
Yeah. But the technology isn't in place to all of a sudden have forecourts full of EVs. And that's the trouble. And also, you've got sellers of cars who will sell what they have in front of them, and they will dissuade people from EVs because they might necessarily be able to access them. We're already taking all the supply of e-Niros and e-Souls, and I had an e-Soul earlier in the week and it was fantastic, really enjoyed it. They're already sold out. The allocation is sold out. Norway is hoovering up all of the EVs that are being built
They've got hydropower in Norway, haven't they?
And
so they've plenty of electricity.
Beautiful, and their model is perfect because, for a start, Norway is filthy rich compared to us. Their electricity is so green and clean, it's ridiculous. So they can actually put all of these things in place with no harm, and then everybody is delighted. You pull into any business, any hotel, any workplace in Norway, in Oslo, any of the places, and you'll find the access point is all dedicated to EVs. And if you have an internal combustion engine, you're chucked out the back of the field, the back of beyond, because everybody has adopted this model because it's so much easier to do over there. The car companies cannot make enough of these, or they are more important.
So
at the
these
moment,
targets
they can't make
that,
enough for profit.
That everybody wants in Europe are just not achievable, you're saying?
Not at the moment.
Not by 2030.
And I always think the language was wrong as well, because it should have been by 2030 we're going to make sure that every car sold is electrified, which would have still included hybrids and allowed engines to be used as generators and so
on. A lot of the new Audi and that, they have mild hybridisation.
Yeah, they've all mild hybrid systems to help pull down the CO2. Because let's face it, by putting the frighteners on everybody over diesel and the current crop of 6C emission diesels, Euro 6C emission diesels, there's nearly baby bunnies coming out of the tailpipe. They're very, very clean in terms of NOx. They're much cleaner than petrol cars in terms of CO2, which is what all these fines potentially are based on. So we should be still able and encouraging people to use cleaner vehicles. And also, hybrids are the very immediate here and now alternative to help reduce CO2. So Europe sets targets on the manufacturers to make CO2 emitting, like by 2020, they'll all have to 95 grams CO2. It's going to drop and drop and drop. So let the industry find a way of giving us cars which produce less pollution. Let's not just insist that electricity is the only way. Now, it is the way, but you can't ram it down people's throat when there's no supply, there's no choice.
What happens to all the cars we have now?
Exactly. Then we have to see how crazy government will go in persecuting people who are on their second-hand car, their used car, which is their only means of transport, who can't afford to buy or make the jump to
an EV. So it's got to be public transport, a lot of it initially, electric buses.
It amazed me that there wasn't a priority given on electric buses or public transport.
Well, I think we are getting three. Dublin Bus are getting three, as I understand. But in China, they've got the largest fleet of electric buses in the world, I believe, in China.
And again, China is interesting because China owned
Reese. And it's very heavily polluted, China. I know Richard was there. I wasn't there, but I believe it's very heavily polluted, the air there.
Yeah, China was driving the whole EV thing. And I think the smaller EVs to buy, which only do short distances, you don't have to enter the lottery to actually own the car. Whereas larger cars, you have to enter a lottery and you've to sometimes wait up to 3 years before you're allowed to buy a car. They've taken all the subsidies away from larger EVs. So the manufacturers, and all the Europeans are based over there as well, they have to all of a sudden make their business model work. And they've got a huge frightener, and that sort of depressed the car sales market globally, because China said, okay, hang on, we've given you incentives, now we're pulling the incentives away. And that's the issue. The manufacturers know that with the strike of a pen, a government can take away incentives. So if you took away the 10 grand incentive that's here on EV cars, all of a sudden your 25 grand Renault Zoe, which is a fine EV for using around the city, it has a 40 kilowatt. The new one is coming with a 52 kilowatt battery in the new year. If you take away that, all of a sudden a 25 grand car where you go, okay, at a push, yeah, that kind of nearly makes sense now, that could possibly do that, becomes 35 grand. And you're going, hang on, 35 grand gets me a lot of car with an internal combustion engine. So we have to gently take the whole population, which has been sold the diesel pot back in 2008, and we all shifted to diesel. We did what we were told. You can't just force people out of something into then a huge spend. A lot of people can't afford to do it. So
it is the future. We're going that way regardless.
We are going that way.
And it's good.
And also to sort of anticipate, Richard, hydrogen fuel cells, that will be the really way to go
Why
forward.
Why hasn't that happened?
No,
it must be 20 years ago when we were in Reykjavik in Iceland and they were piloting hydrogen fuel celled buses.
And
they were.
It hasn't happened.
No, and you will find more buses than cars running on hydrogen fuel. Toyota have the Miura and stuff, but we don't even have a filling station in Ireland, but we will very shortly because the industry has an action group together on this. But the core of the issue is a hydrogen fuel cell is still an electric vehicle. It's an electric motor powering the wheels, or two motors if you want an all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive. It's just the way electricity is generated, and it is the most efficient way. And it's also exciting because in Germany they have trains that they're pioneering of this. So you can have an electric train that doesn't need overhead cables because it has the ability to run on hydrogen fuel.
Anyway, listen, that's all we have time for. Michael, thank you very much indeed. Karen, thank you very much indeed. Hopefully you'll come in again. Richard, thank you. Our researcher is John Riley. Our series producer is Anna Lenny. And on sound we had Noel Roberts. Until next time, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.